Welcome to the Better Money, Better World Show, a podcast project of Impact Capital Managers, or ICM. ICM is a group of investors who believe that by solving the world's greatest challenges, we will generate market-leading returns for investors while bending the arc of human history towards sustainability and justice. ICM members have backed companies ranging from Tesla to Coursera to Vital Farms. Collectively, ICM's 60 members manage over $12 billion. I'm your host, Daniel Pianco, a co-founder of ICM. My day job is co-founder and managing director of Achieve Partners, a leading investor in education and human capital. Here on Better Money, Better World, we'll explore the stories of our investor members, the companies we're building, and the limited partners allocating money to investors who don't just seek alpha, but also to leverage their capital to build a better world. Episodes will be released each week and feature a new guest telling their own unique investment stories, strategies, and perspectives. And we've got lots of great guests lined up. So, if you're excited about what this show might teach you about impact investing and the people behind it, make sure you subscribe to Better Money, Better World wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to highlight the work of impact investors and grow the community of impact investing. Now, with that out of the way, let me introduce you to our Better Money, Better World guests. How people learn is changing. COVID demonstrated for all just how far behind schools are in adapting technology, which means that more spending and capital will be allocated to improving how schools teach and operate in an increasingly digital world. Achieve Partners acquires education technology businesses that are cash flow positive, growing at 20%+ per year, and serve as the picks and shovels of the digitization of the learning environment. Troy Williams, Managing Director of Achieve Partners, believes founders of education technology companies have a secret sauce. Most education technology markets do not behave like typical enterprise SaaS with 60-day sales cycles. Instead, education products can take a year or more to work their way through schools' procurement processes. Williams identifies founder-driven companies that have reached 60 to 100 customers and are ready to scale, such as PackBack, Mainstay, and Ready Education. The Achieve Partners team plans to grow businesses organically through their strong relationships and experience in the education world. Williams started his career as a lawyer, but then started an ebook company in the late 1990s. After selling his business to Cengage Group, Williams joined Macmillan Education, where he started investing in this gap in the education capital markets. Listen as Williams describes Achieve Partners' strategy of partnering with founders to invest in high-growth and high-impact education technology companies. Troy, welcome to the Better Money, Better World podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for making time for me today, Daniel.
We're excited to hear about Achieve's focus on education technology. Can you talk about a deal that represents who you are and the types of companies you love to invest in?
Yeah, sure. So one of my favorite deals was a company called Examity, based in Boston. It is a company that does online remote proctoring of exam takers. And we invested in this company in early 2017. We had a thesis around it in early 2016. So while COVID has perhaps made it obvious that a lot of students need to take exams from home, at the time, it wasn't necessarily obvious to a lot of folks. But Examity was a largely bootstrapped company. We like bootstrapped companies. The company had raised maybe $1 million from friends and family early on in 2013. And from there, it had grown and become cash flow positive and profitable, and had grown quite quickly to about $5 or $6 million in revenue. And it was at that time that we kind of engaged with the founder, and we're very founder focused. So we like to back founders. We think founders have special sauce, and that they're able to scale their businesses better than professional managers, so to speak, at least up to $25 million or so, if not 50 or more. And so it was a founder-focused company, growing nicely, and we had the opportunity to take a control position in that company. And what we do is we look for companies that are growing nicely, typically growing 20 to 50%, maybe faster even. But we're typically not necessarily focused on companies that are growing 100%+. Those companies oftentimes are consumer companies, and we're probably more focused on businesses that are selling to schools or universities. So we invested, and we helped the team there scale and accelerate their growth rate. So they went from like a 30% growth rate to a 60% growth rate during our hold period. And that's part of it. Many times bootstrap companies, while they're growing nice organically, they've had tremendous amount of capital constraint. They've never taken on a significant amount of money. They need to make the bills, make payroll every month. And so they've oftentimes never had more than $1 million on hand. Once we release that capital constraint, it's a good core business. We add some sales and marketing around them and scale those companies. And so Xamity was a company that we grew. We did a couple tuck-in transactions. We grew it to about $16 million in revenue and about $4.5 million in EBITDA in 2 years. And then we plan to do a couple more acquisitions. We looked for an equity partner and had the opportunity to exit at a 5x return in 26 months. So we went ahead and took the money off the table before COVID hit. And the opportunity became obvious to everybody.
So ahead of the curve.
We were in ahead of the curve and out ahead of the curve.
Always good to be outside of curving situations. And it's really interesting because when you talk to most people about educational technology investing, you think about companies like Coursera or Udemy or these sort of, like you said, consumer-oriented companies. Achieve clearly has a different strategy. Can you describe where Achieve fits in the capital stack?
Yeah. So we think we're pretty fairly unique in the capital stack. I mean, when you think about the capital stack, there's normally, you know, kind of three groups: venture, growth, and private equity. And for a whole host of reasons, there's a gap in the education sector when you think about those three areas. The reality is it's really hard to scale an ed tech company that sells to schools or universities early on. It takes years to get to, say, $5 million in revenue. And so venture has the philosophy that you're gonna find a company with $1 million in revenue and a good product, and you're gonna put $8 or $10 million on the balance sheet and blow out the sales and marketing team and grow that company fast. And that works in most sectors. It doesn't work in ed tech, primarily because the buyers at most schools and universities are committees who are not primarily ROI focused. They're primarily institutional. Objectives focused, pedagogically focused, various other criteria. And one of the things they care about most is, has a peer institution bought and used this product, and what's their experience? Well, you have one sales cycle per year in K-12, and it typically takes a year or 18 months to get feedback. And so you can't find a referenceable client, even for your first client, for about 16, 18 months. And so it takes years to get to enough referenceable clients where we can actually scale. And what we think is, that's around 60 to 100 referenceable clients where we believe we can scale those companies. And so that is when a company is usually between 5 and 10 million in revenue. Well, the other thing is, most ed tech products are priced at around $50,000 to $100,000 for a school district or university. And so when you think there are 4,000 universities in the country, roughly 4,000 school districts of size, the TAM on these businesses is usually sub $500 million.
But before, what is TAM?
Right, the addressable market. If you were to sell your product to virtually everybody in the market, that's what your top line revenue could be. So that's what the potential revenue is. And so when you think about the opportunity, most venture capitalists and most growth equity investors are only interested in companies whose TAMs, their opportunity size, is in the billions, if not the many billions. And so consumer ed tech companies, like some of the ones you mentioned, they do have TAMs in the billions. But product spot solutions that sell into school districts or universities, their TAMs typically aren't anywhere near that. And so they just don't fit most venture or growth equity investors. They do fit private equity. Private equity loves ed tech because while it's hard to get that sale and the sales cycle is much longer, you know, because I'd say most corporate SaaS businesses, your sales cycle should be sub 90 days, maybe even sub 60 days. Whereas here we're talking about 9 to 18 months. Well, the reason that the market works is once you do get a sale, you keep it for a decade or more. These are governmental kind of contracts. They go up every year. You get locked in. And you're able to maintain that contract for a long time. So private equity loves that. They love that recurring nature of the business. But what's happened in private equity over the last decade is funds have really upsized. So your $500 million fund is now a $5 billion fund. And they really need to write $200 million checks or more. And so they can't come down to a $5 or $10 million business. They need to see $25, $50 million in revenue and $3 million minimum of EBITDA, but usually more like $5 or $10 million in EBITDA to do what they do and put leverage on it, debt on it. And so there is this gap in ed tech. There's tens of thousands of companies in the space, and the vast majority of them are sub $15 million in revenue. And they really don't fit venture because they're growth because their TAM's too small. And they're not yet big enough for private equity. And we think that that's just a massive cap bust in the market, so to speak, in the capital stack. And that's where we focus is in that space.
And so what do you say to someone who says, oh, ed tech, it's not a big enough market to support a buyout strategy like this? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely a huge market. I mean, so education is 6% of GDP in the U.S. And so that is a very large market. When you think about healthcare, I think is roughly 18% of the market. So when people say that and they think that education's a niche market, it's because I think, you know, when you hear that from a financial professional, at least, it's because you don't have it tracked by analysts on Wall Street the same way that utilities or health or, you know, various other sectors, pharma, whatever, are tracked as an industry. The reason that they are not tracked on Wall Street is you have 0.1% of public market capitalizations in the United States as education companies, but it's this massive market, right? And so how do you square those two things? The reality is it means it's an incredibly diffuse market. You have that many more companies, tens of thousands of companies that are very small, relatively small, which is where we're focused. And then the other thing to think about is education is a global phenomenon. Right?
I've heard people in other countries get educated too. Yes, that's a great point.
Right? So even in this country, it's a massive market. But then you think about it globally, and so it's even that much bigger. Whereas, you know, certain other sectors, if you're thinking about network SaaS, there are demands around the world, but if the education market in other countries is very large relative to the U.S. market in a way that you wouldn't see that in some other sectors. So it's an incredibly diffuse and incredibly large market with tons of opportunity, and it's really underinvested in. There's very few pure play ed tech investors the way there are pure play healthcare investors, or we could go down the line, fintech investors, whatever it is. There's tons more doing those, which are really relatively smaller markets.
Now, one of the classic criticisms of ed tech is the products don't work. So how do you address that criticism, and how do you then create sort of an impact strategy around achieved partner strategy in the sector?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that's certainly important to what we focus on and why we're doing what we're doing is, you know, billions of dollars have gone into ed tech over the last decade, and it's unclear whether those things have actually really had a massive impact on student outcomes. In some cases, you can point to two places where there have been, you know, substantial step function gains, but in most cases, it's less clear. And the reason for that is it's really hard to tell, to control for one thing in an environment. When you have a classroom with 30, 40 kids in it, and there's a ton of different things going on, coming in, coming out. The reality is, again, the parallel to healthcare is there. If you take a pill, to know whether or not that pill actually improved or didn't, we have to do these massive random control trials, right? That's what big pharma does. Education's similar, but we can't do these massive random control trials on kids, right? And so it's hard to actually point to results. And so what we're doing and what we've done with our new fund is made a commitment that with every investment, we're going to partner with a university based researcher who's going to study the data on our company and have the ability to publish that report in peer-reviewed journals, whether or not it's beneficial to our company, so that we're constantly building the published research about these products. And impact's absolutely important to us, but we want to advance it not just for our companies, but for the entire ecosystem.
So are you going to actually have third-party academic research on the companies you buy?
Absolutely. That's the commitment we're making on every case. There's going to be third-party academic research. And we had a conversation with a dean of one of the schools of education who's been asked to do this in the past at different points. And of course, he said, well, what if the data's not good for your company? And we said, go ahead and publish it. And he was kind of stunned because I think other folks who have occasionally looked to have research done, they only want it published if it's good for them. And our view is, look, we only have a 5 to 7 year hold period. It takes a couple years for the research to get out there. It takes a couple years for everybody to read it. We want to advance it. And the reality is we're gonna be able to improve our products based on this type of research and be back in the market with a better product, even if there is some bad research out there on a product. We're not that worried about it. We know we're going to be able to scale these businesses.
That's really interesting that you're doing research on each company. Can you talk about how that's sort of worked in the past with one of the companies that you've invested in?
Yeah, so we invested in a company called Mainstay, based in Boston. It's in conversational AI, which for most people, that means a chatbot. They have, unlike most other companies in the space, they have their own patented technology. They're not using a generic chatbot from Google or somebody else. And what they do, their first product was designed to solve something called Summer Melt. Summer Melt is where students get accepted into a university, a college, a university in the spring, but never show up in the fall. And Summer Melt is a really big problem with first generation college students, especially students from certain socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds. And so what the chatbot does is it interacts with the student during the entire summer and gives the student the opportunity to ask questions. And they could be just generic questions that they might not be comfortable asking or might not know who to ask. But getting those answers back quickly at 2 o'clock in the morning when they're worried about it, turns out that dramatically reduces summer melt. And so then now, you know, Mainstay has built an additional product that works once the student's actually on campus, because those first few months on campus for a first generation student can be incredibly daunting. There's lots of unknowns and self-doubt in many cases and various other things. And you have to remove all those barriers to enable that student to succeed. And they have lots of questions. And even though the staff on a university has the best of intentions, they're not available at 2 o'clock in the morning and they're not available for a lot of these questions. And so what the chatbot does is it answers the vast majority of them, like 70% of the questions, like automatically, instantaneously. And if it's a bigger question or a question that's not easily answered by the chatbot, it's kind of flagged for someone to answer it the next day. But it's now reduced the load on the university staff pretty dramatically. So how do,
in that case, like, do you track summer melt for people by population, like, yeah, Pell Grant, African American, Latino?
Right. Yeah.
How do you show the impact through those studies?
Well, so we work with the universities that have actually adopted this product. So universities, one university that's published the most, I think, is Georgia State. It's been in the New York Times. You can look up that article. And so Georgia State found that when they implemented this technology, there was a substantial increase in first, the reduction of summer melt by certain populations. And then once those students were on campus, they persisted longer than students who didn't have access to that chatbot.
That's great. And you know, one of the things that I always find interesting about you is you come from a very non-traditional background into investing. Tell me, like, you started a company, you're an entrepreneur, so you, yeah, were the, you do have a unique connection to people, you said founder focused. Tell me about the company you founded and sort of how that impacts how you are an investor today.
Yeah, so I founded a company called Questia back in 1998. It was, at the time, there were no books online. You could buy a book from Amazon, but you just had the cover art and, you know, you could get it sent to you. But I had the vision that all those books that were in the library should be searchable and accessible online in the same way that the law cases I had as a lawyer were online, and I could search the full text of them. So you could find a quote. What book did this quote come from? Plug it into a search engine, find what book it came from, read right there. And I really felt like that would democratize access to education if everybody around the world had effectively Harvard's library.
You're a modern day Carnegie, right? That creating was, libraries.
You know, so it's funny. That was the vision. There were a lot of librarians who didn't like me. I remember I was called some names at the American Library Association when I was speaking back in 2000. But anyway, we raised a lot of venture capital. Obviously, the dot-com crash caused us to have to reset the company. Ended up running it for 9 years and selling to Cengage. But we digitized. We were just too early, really. Was the fact is we had to start with paper copies of books and scan them and tag them in XML and various other things in order to make them searchable and usable. And a few years later, people were able to start with electronic copies of all the books. So we were, you know, being early is sometimes the same thing as being wrong, but we had a vision of doing that. And the reality is what that gives me today is an affinity for founders. I know that they're up at 2 o'clock in the morning, unable to sleep, worried about issues. I know the dark, lonely days that it is to be a founder, and I can commiserate with that. And hopefully I can give them some advice from having not only operated my own company for 9 years, but then having moved on to, you know, a major corporation and having operated a whole group of companies there as well, that some of these challenges that feel distinct to a founder and like they've just come upon it and they feel like they're the only one facing it, that no, these are routine. It's okay. Here's how you're going to get by it. And here's some ideas about how you got by it. Here's how I solved this once. That can be really valuable. So, you know, for many people, it's a parallel to parenting. Your parent, when you have a 7-year-old or a 12-year-old, they can feel like the challenge they have today is de novo, kind of first time. It's first time for them. So it's big and scary. But the reality is everybody goes through those stages of life, right? And so it's giving them that perspective that and saying, hey, I'm here with you, that can enable us to have a deep relationship with a founder and them to have the confidence that we're not just financial engineers coming in investing. We're actually there to partner with them and scale their business to scale the impact that they've dreamed of having. And that's the key thing. We invest in mission-driven founders who are trying to change the world. And what we say to them is we're gonna accelerate your impact when we partner with you. And that usually gets them pretty excited.
Now, you also have a different thing that's a little non-traditional, in that your family has been in this country for about 3 centuries, but you're the first person in your family to go to college. Tell me how did you overachieve, and then how does that impact how you invest today?
You're right. Neither of my parents, my grandparents, had gone to college. My brother actually did go to college 2 years ahead of me. So I'm first generation college, but I'm not first in the family. But that was part of it is, you know, to be perfectly honest, my dad is an incredibly hard worker. And he got me up early in the morning on the weekends to work with him. And he works at an incredible pace. And I really realized I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. And
what does he do?
He was a plumber. Yeah. So I worked with him on the weekends. And during the summers.
So in addition to coaching entrepreneurs, you can help them with any plumbing issues that develop. Is that what we're learning today?
I don't know. I think there's probably somebody else who can help better with that. I'll probably screw it up.
But you know, you're helping to create the classroom of the future, right? I mean, some of the companies that you've mentioned, whether that's the AI chatbot or, you know, the company like Packback, which is redefining how we interact in an online classroom. What does the classroom of the future look like to you?
Well, I think, you know, the thing about education is it's relatively slow moving change, right? So we can see the trend lines, but it's going to take time to get there. So the future could be, you know, obviously a year from now is the future, and so is 20 years from now, and so is 100 years from now. And I really have gotten out of the business of predicting when something's going to happen, because It's usually slower than I think it's going to happen. The reality is, I think what's happening is we have a trend line toward personalization. Administratively in K-12, you have things called IEPs, you know, individualized learning plans for various sets of students. I think the reality is in the future, effectively, every student's going to have their individualized learning plan, and the technology is going to help provide them and assess them in real time without them having to necessarily take a test in ways that enable you to provide the right content in their learning style at the right point in time. And so we've talked about personalized learning or adaptive learning now for a decade. It's probably still a long way off because it's really complex to do. But I think that is the future, is increasingly personalized learning. You think back when we were kids, and still today, you have a lot of Montessori schools and different things, which really effectively were personalized learning, like an environment for personalized learning. And I think those things, I think everybody's heading in that same direction. It's just technology hopefully intermediates that and increasingly becomes seamless and kind of almost camouflaged. I don't think the teacher goes away, but I think the technology is going to enable that interaction to be increasingly personalized in the future.
Now, most of the companies you invest in are actually selling to schools and almost administrative software. So, you said classrooms haven't changed a lot since we were kids. Tell me about the back office of a lot of these schools and universities.
Yeah. So, I think across the educational ecosystem, one of the things that makes our job a little bit easier is universities and school districts tend to be a decade behind corporations. And so we can look at what's happening in corporations, say, 2 years ago, and it's still the future over on the educational side. And that's true on the administrative side, because, I think COVID caught a number of school districts off guard where they hadn't moved their systems to the cloud yet, which most corporations have moved their systems to the cloud a decade ago, right? And so you have those trend lines of mobile first technology. So your millennial workforce, increasingly millennial workforce, or even Gen Z, beginning to be Gen Z workforce coming in, want to be able to interact with administrative systems on their phone or on their iPad from home. And when you have on-premises software that was written in the 1990s, at the school district, it doesn't support that, right? And so there's a huge, trend line over the next decade of replacing most of those administrative systems that are really dinosaurs, that date back 10, 15, 20 years or more. And the reality is some workflow processes have never gotten off of spreadsheets or paper and pencil. To some extent, and that just has to change. And the states are driving that too, because the states are increasingly being data and analytic focused, in the sense that they're trying to track things longitudinally across different cohorts, and they have to have data. And so those systems have to tie into what the state is trying to do in many states, not all states.
So, is it true then that the connectivity between these, are there 50 systems, 100 systems? Like, how do I think about the scale of this problem?
Yeah, so, it depends on the sector. So when we look at, say, just K-12 back office systems, we would sketch out 12 or 15 different sectors, if not more. And then in each one of those sectors, there's subsectors with 5 or 6 or 7 different players in each subsector. So it's an incredibly diffuse market. And what I would say is, that environment is one where there isn't a lot of interplay between those systems. There are some companies that came along to try to really kind of become the common bus in the background, and everybody kind of plugs into them. And so there is movement in that direction. There's still a lot of need, but you have a lot of spot solutions in this space. And so the interplay, you have some different standards that some standards bodies have released that allow everybody kind of to play nice and the data to flow in certain sectors, but in other sectors there's really no standard yet and there's no kind of common bus. So that is a challenge on the background. And I would say the reality is politically, some of this stuff, the political, occasionally this ed tech stuff becomes politicized, right? A few years ago, Common Core became politicized. And then there were a couple of movements for data sharing across the states that were adopting the Common Core. And there was a fear that, you know, when we were kids, we always got threatened with our permanent record, which didn't exist. But there was a fear that for the first time, there was going to be a permanent record.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Parents don't want their kids to have a permanent record, right?
What was that 80s movie? This will go on your permanent record.
Exactly. Right. And so there is a desire. And I mean, I think unique in America versus what you would see in Europe or Australia or some other parts of Commonwealth countries of saying, look, we don't want our children's data being owned by a third party. And so there is this, you know, piecemeal approach that is part of our federal system in the US of having 50 different systems. And in fact, education, as probably all your listeners know, is locally controlled. So even inside a state, it's a local county, or even inside of a county, a town. You know, I live in Connecticut, so it's all town-based, really. I mean, you know, I had a local town that only graduated 50 students last year, and they just decided to build a $70 million high school when they should have just partnered with the town next door who was building a high school and only had 150 kids. Like, why wouldn't you just build one high school for 200 kids? But they built two high schools. And so that is the reality of our educational system. And so people want the data to stay kind of at a much more local level.
It's like enforced inefficiency.
Yeah. And so there has to be so technologically it needs to be a common system, but then you need to make sure that the data is not being aggregated.
Right.
So there are challenges, and part of it comes from our sensibility and our political norms that we don't want some of the efficiency there. And I would just say, you know, everybody's gone through the educational system. And so one of the challenges I have is when I'm talking to generalist investors or generalist people around, they all think they know a lot about education because they went to school. And well, when I went to school, all right, you know, you hear that. And the reality is one of the challenges in the financial community is most people in the financial community went to elite schools, right? They went to schools that actually don't, most of 4,000 universities in the country don't look like the top 30 institutions that most of financial professionals went to, but they assume they are. They're like, oh, they must be similar, right? And it's just different challenges.
So we won't hold your Harvard Law degree against you, but is that sort of how you also kind of work with founders? Like, what is your secret sauce when you start sitting down with a founder and sort of convincing them to sell to you as opposed to another firm?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I try to do is spend time getting to know a founder early on to make sure I want to back them and that I believe that they can scale this business with our help, that they're mission driven. But like I said earlier, there's usually these challenges. They're somewhat distinct in every case, but there's generally a theme behind it. And I try to help them through some of those challenges before we invest. Our philosophy is to get to know a founder for a year or more before we invest, not to respond to a pitch book that's coming in, right? And so if a pitch book's coming in, we'll probably take a meeting, but it's really in the interest of potentially investing a year or two down the road, not in the next 30 days. And so then what we try to do is sit down with them and actually talk about the challenges. One of my favorite questions for a founder in a first meeting is, what's your biggest challenge right now? And then they'll tell me a couple things. And I ask, well, how are you approaching that? What is your strategy to solve that? And then I might throw out some different things that I've seen work in the past. And it's kind of more of like a brainstorming session. And if they react well to that, that's great. And then I can check back in 3 to 6 months later and see if they've solved that problem and how they solved that problem. We can talk through it again. And it's that kind of like willingness to work from an operational perspective that I think they see as distinct from most financial investors.
That's great. Do you think that, you know, crystal ball out, you know, 5-10 years forward, what do you think the biggest change in the education investing market will be?
I think COVID has made it obvious to a lot of people that the educational system requires a lot more investment and that the technology side is lagging, say, the corporate technology piece. And so I think you've seen a lot of people say that they're going to devote a lot of money to the investing space. So we're seeing a lot more generalist investors come in. The reality is this is kind of like the fourth wave in my experience. I mean, I saw a bunch of generalists in 2000 during the dot-com boom. I saw a bunch of generalists in 2007 just before the financial crisis, and then 2015, and now since COVID, it's the fourth wave. The other three times we saw them all leave once they realized how hard it was. But what's changing right now is you're seeing a number of companies make it out into the public market. So last year, Coursera made it out. Chegg's been out there. Udemy, a number of others are making it into the public market. You're seeing in various other parts around the world a lot of investment in education technology as well in Asia and Europe. And so I do think it's going to be recognized as an investment class 10 years from now in a way that it's not today.
So, and again, it's probably my last question. Do you think in 10 years, the education investing landscape looks more like healthcare or more like sort of a niche, still sort of more of a niche?
I think we're on our way. I think if you go back to the 90s, I think healthcare at that time was 9% of GDP and only 2% of public market caps. And I think today it's 18% of GDP and like 14% of public market caps. And so I do think I think education will go that path. I think healthcare and education are the two things people care most about, is their health, their kids' health, and their kids' education. There's a lot of public components to both. There's a lot of complexity around things we talked about, testing and figuring out what works. So I do think like that's not going to change. That's human nature. Education and healthcare are really, really important to people. What is going to happen is I do think you're probably going to see education at 7-8% of GDP and probably 2-3% of public market caps in a decade. It's probably 2 or 3 decades before it kind of catches up. It's just been running a couple decades behind healthcare. So I think it's probably coming.
Well, hopefully with your help, we'll have a lot more people thinking about impact and thinking about pro-social activities who are buying these companies and building them. So thank you, Troy, so much for your time.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you.
And appreciate all that you do for the industry.
Great. Thanks.
This is Marika Spence, Executive Director of Impact Capital Managers. Better Money, Better World is made possible in part by ICM, a nonprofit network of over 60 best-in-class fund managers investing for superior returns and meaningful impact across North America and beyond. Our members share a passion for partnering with entrepreneurs and scaling companies that will realize a more resilient, equitable, and sustainable future. If you enjoyed today's conversation, tune in for the next episode of Better Money, Better World. Tell your friends and visit us online at www.impactcapitalmanagers.com.
Please note, Better Money, Better World host Daniel Pianco is co-founder and managing director of Achieve Partners. Information presented on this program is believed to be factual and up-to-date, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, and it should not be regarded as complete analysis of the subjects discussed. Discussions and answers to questions do not involve the rendering of personalized investment advice, but are limited to the dissemination of general information. Achieve Partners is registered as an investment advisor with the SEC, and only transacts businesses in states where it is properly registered or is excluded or exempted from registration requirements.